people don't want to be changed, but they don't mind change, right? So I think that's the interesting thing, whereas if it feels sort of artificial or somebody is forcing somebody to do something they either don't agree with or don't understand why, of course they're going to be really resentful around that.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast that helps software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Patrick Kwa. Patrick is the chief scientist and former CTO at N26 in Germany. He was brought in to the N26 team as a shakeup CTO, digital transformation. He helped them scale from 55 to 250 full-time engineers in 18 months. That's a 4x increase. Today, there are over 400 engineers. He's also the author of 3 books, including The Retrospective Handbook, Building Evolutionary Architecture, and Talking with Tech Leaders. Patrick is one of the foremost experts on retrospectives. The good news is you don't have to be world-class to run a good retro that brings value. And Patrick shares some of his tips on how to get started and how to make things better for our teams tomorrow. Patrick also shares how to manage change. Change management is a pretty boring topic, but as high-growth teams, we have to be good at it. High-growth leadership is about change management, and Patrick has some practical tips how we can all be a little bit better. And now, here's my conversation with Patrick Kwa. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
What is the biggest inflection point in your career that's gotten you to where you are today?
I think for me, one of the biggest inflection points was joining the consultancy ThoughtWorks. One of this was because I had a lot of autonomy, really. You know, one of the biggest things that you're expected to have as a consultant is really do whatever you think is right that helps the customer. And when you're surrounded by great people and a simple but clear mission, I think you really thrive in that sort of environment. So for me, I think that was where I had a lot of ability to grow, learn from other people with really different backgrounds, different skills. So not just programming, but sort of project management, relationships with customers, sort of senior leadership. Everyone is really accessible. And ThoughtWorks was very distributed as well. So I started off with them in Australia. So you also got to benefit, I guess, from a global network of people around the world, tapped into seeing trends with different technology companies. And I think that was probably the biggest pivot for me, which has really helped accelerate my growth, both personally and also sort of professionally.
So it was the cross-functional nature and just quality of folks on that team that you felt really accelerated your career?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is back then, I started quite a while ago, almost 20 years, I think a lot of consultancies were maybe a bit more focused on the sort of professionalism, right? You had to dress the part, you had to look good, you had to say the right things. And I think ThoughtWorks was kind of a little bit more what you'd imagine Silicon Valley today being of, you know, doesn't matter what you're dressed like, what really matters is the results and how well you can work with other people to solve very complex problems. So I think the sort of informality was really conducive to bringing in so many different perspectives to solving complex scaling technical problems or organizational problems. And you learn from each other in that experience, from each other, sort of building upon each other's ideas, and then sort of trying new things out. And also, I guess, benefiting from the results of other people's experiments and then sort of being able to transplant that across sort of countries and introducing new ideas to sort of companies that are trying to transform.
So now you're at a very fast-growing bank at N26. How much of that informal nature and some of that idea spreading have you been able to exist already at N26, or have you been able to import?
Yeah, I think I've definitely been able to import quite a lot. I mean, I think one advantage of a startup is that there's a lot of less sort of rigid structure. When I was a consultant and you worked with maybe larger banks, governments, companies that have been around for 20, 30 years, there's a lot of culture and process that has built up over time. And I think that's one of the fun parts of startup and why I sort of got into the stage of where it was at, where, you know, there's a lot of informality as part of that. But I think one of the interesting sort of journeys that N26 is on is that given that the founding sort of group didn't have any tech background, both business and finance background, there's also a side to informality which doesn't really come through sometimes. But I think over the sort of 2 and a bit years that I've been here, we've really shifted that culture where, you know, we feel a lot more like a tech company where we can sort of cross borders regardless of title and hierarchy in order to get things done, which is super important when you deal with even more complex problems as your organization scales and grows as well. So I think that's been a really fun thing to do, to sort of cultivate and keep this sort of cross-functional collaboration, particularly across departments, as a company grows.
So it sounds like you kind of shook things up a little bit in that 2.5 years. I'd love to hear how does that operationalize? Like, you come in to shake things up. How do you actually do that?
Yeah, I think one of the benefits I had as a consultant is that I'd seen so many companies at different stages. So ThoughtWorks probably doesn't work with really, really early stage companies, but they tend to work with the companies that are having the sort of scaling problems. And then you're working with a lot of other companies who are maybe trying to digitally transform, move faster, sort of change their culture to take on perhaps what was a brick and mortars culture, to really think a lot more about what does it mean to be a digital first or tech culture. And I think one of the reasons I came into N26 was like the shakeup, as you described, to sort of help us sort of think about moving out of that early stage startup and with the authority to help really make decisions. So I think for me, one of the real key lessons learned, I guess, was, you know, I think every organization is different. Every organization has problems at different stages. And, you know, I don't think you can approach any company with like a cookie cutter approach, which is like, here is what you have to do right now.
The best practices.
Yeah, no, that doesn't really work because everyone is experiencing different problems. So best practices are great if you know exactly the problem that you're dealing with. But often those issues or constraints are very different, and timing-wise, they're very different. So done too early, you're going to like over-optimize perhaps and maybe add in process you don't need. Too late, and you're going to feel a lot of pain, and it'll be harder to maybe shift that sort of momentum. So I think a lot of the thing that I did when I first came in was really starting to look at what were the constraining behaviors or processes that were already at play, really trying to contextualize and sort of orient myself around what was the state of the company at that time. And I think one of the ways that I really did that was really by spending a lot of time with different teams, people at different levels, not just in my team, but across other teams who sort of impact either further upstream in terms of maybe business ideas or sort of maybe further downstream in terms of when you release a product, people who provide customer support and operations and the back office sort of stuff, to sort of get a good picture of like where we were and where the sort of pain points were. You know, I knew that I was going to join a very rapidly growing company, and you can't solve all those problems as well at the same time. And I think this is part of the sort of idea of first really trying to go in, understand what the sort of list of all the possible things you could work on, and then like any good leader, trying to really prioritize which things you think will have the most impact.
So you went in, it sounds like you had conversations with people who were not just engineers. You were meeting with back office folks, people who were like engineer adjacent, closer to the customer. And then your goal was to prioritize problems. I'd love to hear some examples of, so context, you were about 60 engineers, is that right, when you started?
So we were actually a tech team of about 50, 55. So we had help desk and tech ops. So engineering was even less.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but the rest of the company was about 450 people. So kind of a small percentage for what you imagine a tech company might be. Significantly different now, but back then there was definitely a lot of other parts of the business that I could talk to and not just focusing on the tech team.
That makes sense.
So an example of how is sort of collecting this information. So with all the tech teams, naturally you can use one-on-ones to sort of talk to people around that. But having worked in an agile environment for a long time and also having written a book on retrospectives, that was a natural tool for me to use. So I sort of went in very early on running workshops, effectively retrospective workshops with all different types of teams. And I sort of asked a couple of different questions, right? So one, which is like, what are the things that you're really proud of? Because I think in terms of knowing what to scale up, you don't want to lose the things that are already working. So you don't want to break the things that are already really working. You know, another question was really around like what's not going so well. So, you know, things that are maybe painful or maybe that aren't as optimal as what could possibly be. And then one of my favorite questions in retrospect is puzzles, because it's kind of something that doesn't really fit into either category, right? Like people don't know if it's good or bad, and they don't necessarily have the answer to it. And that surfaces a whole bunch of interesting questions. You know, some of the things that appear in puzzles, I always sort of contextualize it, is that I may not be the right person to actually create clarity on it. But I think as a leadership team, it's like useful input, because if people in your organization are puzzled, it means that context or direction or information is missing, right? So may not be good or bad, it just is information. And I think those three questions are very powerful.
So that third question, that's a new one for me. So you would ask, what's puzzling us, or what are we confused about? Is that the kind of puzzle we're talking about?
Like, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And what are some of the things that people came up with when you asked them that question?
It's a long time ago now, but I think some of it is like, why are we doing this? So maybe why are we working on this topic? Or, you know, how does this process work? Which is a very natural thing in a startup, because in an early stage startup, nothing is normally documented very well, or the processes keep evolving and nobody is told as the organization gets bigger, except for those people who are maybe making those decisions about why things have evolved and changed. Perhaps it's just visibility, right? Like how does like customer services work if you're in tech? Because, you know, the teams have gotten so big that they're no longer sitting near them, that those departments are also evolving, but people don't have visibility around that.
I love that idea. So if you can come in early and you can create clarity around the things that people are puzzled by, like even if you don't necessarily change anything, you've brought value, you've helped stuff. I really like that that question. That's a new one.
And I'll actually say it's actually something that, particularly in rapidly growing companies, I think it's a really useful one. I actually did some recent sort of retrospective-like workshops like this for our people department. And puzzles was like one of those ones where, you know, it was interesting because even me not being part of the people department, within their own group, there was lots of puzzles, right? So in a rapidly changing environment, everyone can always benefit from it.
We just did our first employee survey where we only have 7 people at Woven right now, and we used Gusto to do their built-in employee survey. And I was, you know, coming in like, oh, we're going to nail this. We're 7 people. We have shared context. And there was a teamwork question on our roles and responsibilities clear. And only 40% of our 7 people strongly agreed with that. So like, even though we're small, we've been growing fast. I think there's some lack of clarity around, you know, what am I doing? That seems like the most important puzzle. So
yes,
I can only imagine that thing continues to exist at 55 people.
Yeah, absolutely. And even more as the organization grows.
One of the downsides of that rapid growth and that change is often a hit to morale. So it's hard to change quickly. It just like wears on people. So whenever you were brought in, you were changing things, you were helping people solve puzzles. How did you manage that that morale, that feeling of things are changing too fast or the wrong direction?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that contribute to morale, and change can definitely affect it. I think there's a great sort of phrase that I heard from somebody. I don't know where the source is now, but you know, it's that people don't want to be changed, but they don't mind change, right? So I think that's the interesting thing, whereas if it feels sort of artificial or somebody is forcing somebody to do something they either don't agree with or don't understand why, of course they're going to be really resentful around that. And so one of the reasons I sort of did retrospectives very early on is kind of my approach to sort of leadership and management, which is really trying to sort of look at the environment. So I use the gardening metaphor quite a lot here, right? Which is like, you need to be conscious about the environment you're cultivating. You can't sort of force culture. You can't force certain behaviors. But what you want to think about is the environment around that. And often in a rapidly growing and sort of company, what you're really thinking about is particularly those things that nobody seems empowered or feels empowered to take care of. And that's the responsibility of management, right? Like the things that fall between teams, between individuals, where they don't autonomously work out a way to actually solve that. And so when I think about change, and this is one of the reasons why the retrospectives were really key, is that what I was like looking for were kind of the common underlying themes that a lot of people were feeling, right? So we're a data-driven organization, and this is my way of sort of collecting information and data, of trying to say, okay, you know, I could fix that, but what is it that people are sensing and feeling? And so when you're introducing change, you know, the first thing is everyone's thinking, how does this affect me? You know, is it going to make my life worse or better? And, you know, I think the reason why you should be wanting to implement change is to make everyone's life better. And so in that way, I think if people can see how the changes make that better or address a problem that they're having, then naturally that should hopefully also improve morale. You know, to give you a concrete example, I think one of the things that I noticed early on was as the company was growing, people's individual attention, so personal growth and sort of mentoring, wasn't really being taken care of. You know, our tech leads were really great people, but I also don't think you can be a really great tech lead if you're managing sort of 10 people and you're also responsible for a really complex technical system. Like, you end up prioritizing implicitly. And unfortunately, a lot of people end up sort of prioritizing the system, which is fair, but also at the trade-off of sort of addressing people, support and growth. And for me, you know, there's a famous Google study, I think it's Project Oxygen.
About teams and leaders?
Yeah, I think it was
Oxygen. There was Aristotle, right? And Oxygen. I can't remember which one's which.
I always mix them up as well, but maybe it's Aristotle. So one was talking about the teams and the other one was talking about the role of managers. And, you know, I think I've seen this where engineers say, oh, I don't want to have managers. But then actually there's a whole bunch of things that never, ever happen, which you kind of need at scale. And that's one of the reasons why we actually brought in engineering management to address this kind of issue of, you know, people just not having a place to go. And, you know, the default is everyone goes up when there's a problem that no one seems to be dealing with. And you can't keep going up. Ultimately, it was to me because I'm not scalable with the rest of the organization whenever something happens, right? So, you know, when people need to take personal leave and they need to talk about, you know, can I take out 2 weeks because I have a personal issue I need to take care of, right? The further somebody is away from a team, the less context that they'll be able to have. And it just doesn't really scale. So that's one of the reasons why we've brought in engineering management, to sort of help people be a lot more supported, to sort of separate some of the people management outside of sort of technical leadership role, and also to sort of add in new capability. So I think key here is really listening to sort of pain points that everyone is having. And really your responsibility as leaders or managers is really to sort of take care of those things that nobody seems capable of sort of dealing with, or that fall between the cracks just because nobody sees it as a key responsibility.
So you do retros, you find out that a common theme is people aren't feeling like their personal career growth stuff is getting taken care of because tech leads have 10 folks and they will probably prioritize the system or they have to make some priority because they can't be two people. You brought in engineering managers and that allowed you to kind of focus on that, you know, when can I take PTO and more context-laden people decisions.
Exactly.
And so how do you structure those teams between tech leads and engineering managers right now?
So it's evolved very rapidly. One of the other things that I was very conscious of doing was knowing what structures would break down at certain sizes. So, you know, to give you an example, I think as a combined product and tech organization, we were probably about 70 people when I first joined. Today, just over 2 years later, we're 420 people. So we've effectively been about three types of companies or four in that time frame. And you need a very different sort of structure to allow autonomy and alignment. And so one of the tools I introduced very early on was this idea of a target operating model. So given this size of an organization for this time frame, here are the structures and the roles that we would want at that sort of phase. So when you talk about when I introduce engineering managers, that's what we had as the target operating model 1.0. So I versioned it like a good software engineer,
nice,
knowing it wouldn't be the last one. And at that level, engineering managers were actually at a team level. So the idea is that they would work with tech leads. Engineering manager would be at a team level. And then with the sort of combined product and tech sort of team, they would take care of particularly the tech side, amongst other types of responsibilities, sort of like delivery management, communication, sort of the things that would create more transparency. What actually happened is obviously our organization grew, and I ended up bringing a director of software engineering in to try to sort of, you know, because I couldn't manage all tech leads and engineering managers, I needed to make sure I scaled myself, and that's a normal sort of division. So VP engineering, looking at sort of the delivery structure, people, organization shape, and CTO looking at more of the technology roadmap, architecture. And one of the conversations we had was the sort of role of the engineering manager. So by the time director of engineering joined, we had grown a little bit more. And so we also needed to revisit our target operating model. So that actually led to 1.1. And that led to the introduction of what we call like a product group. And the engineering manager kind of ended up at the group level rather than at a team level. So if you can imagine, a team gets really big, but when you look at a really complex product portfolio, the team composition needs to change depending on things like the domain, like if something's more infrastructure heavy or more front end heavy, you need different skill sets there. Also, the sort of needs of those domains will change. So sometimes it makes sense to have a short-term working group of, say, three people working on an integration thing, and then those people to fold back in. You know, a team might need to split to cope with a new sort of complexity. And that's what the idea of this product group was supposed to be, is that engineering managers would work with their product group to determine the right structures, the right roles and skill sets, and the right sort of team division. So that was like a big fundamental shift in how we were working in sort of the 1.1 version. We're technically now on a 1.2 version. So our product group sort of model has allowed us to scale quite well. But now we have a lot of product groups, and we also need a way of aligning those groups to make sure that within related groups, they can actually not rely on sort of escalating things to get alignment. And so we actually now have the concept of a product segment, with a couple of key product and engineering roles to help align the segment across common goals. And then the same product groups still sit within a segment so they can maintain their autonomy and sort of staffing skills.
So I want to hear more about, you wrote a whole book about retrospectives, and I love retrospectives. So I'd love to hear your take on what does a world-class retrospective look like.
Yeah, I love retrospectives as well. I think what's interesting is, like, it's interesting to use the term world-class because I actually don't think teams need world-class. Like, obviously, you can always improve retrospectives. But for me, retrospectives are a tool to make sure that your team and your organization is just constantly improving. And so for me, the key basis of a retrospective is change, positive change happening based on a group's decision to, you know, change the way that they're working or to have impact. I think one of the great things that I love about retrospectives is kind of giving people explicit permission is that you have power to do something about your situation. And I love the empowering aspect of that because I think before retrospectives, I think everyone's like, well, I complain and I expect somebody to take care of it, right? Like, it's not very an empowering attitude. So for me, I think a really good retrospective is really one that creates this sense of autonomy, of empowerment, and that also results in positive change.
So maybe we don't need to shoot for world class. We need to shoot for this is making a difference and positive change.
Absolutely.
I don't know if the statement, maybe retrospectives are like pizza, even if it's pretty bad, it's still pretty good. Maybe
I've never heard of that one, but yeah.
What are some common mistakes you see made in retrospectives that keep them from actually creating that agency and positive change?
So I think one of the ones that is very common is kind of repetition. So humans need something different to keep engaged. So I think we all acclimatize or get accustomed to the same thing over and over. And, you know, I think if you keep the same retrospective format again and again, then of course people get bored and maybe start to get disengaged. So I think about like asking different questions, think about changing the format, changing the location, inviting other types of facilitators in to get different flavors, but just basically keep it fresh. Otherwise, like people get bored, right? I think another sort of common mistake is that often teams kind of seem to delegate facilitation to perhaps somebody like a scrum master or an agile coach. And, you know, for me, that's a kind of a sign of a symbiotic relationship, but not an empowered team, right? So it's kind of like the team goes, well, we want to give that to somebody else. And that's good because we don't have to worry about facilitation. But you end up in this, like, we're happy and the Scrum Master or Agile Coach is happy, but actually the team isn't learning new skills. So I always strive to really get to a point where this facilitator role is sort of rotating across the team members, because I think that really creates a lot more empowerment, right? So it creates more learning opportunities, and it also gives more responsibility to other people to sort of grow. And I think that's another common mistake that happens. The final mistake, which I think everyone sees as well, is not really coming up with concrete action items or something that results in change. And I think that's the biggest problem, because I think then what happens is, obviously, if no concrete actions come out or no change comes out, then it's likely the same topics will come up again and again, and then people will stop valuing the retrospective, right? People are like, oh, we're meeting again, but we're still talking about the same topic again and again, and nothing seems to have changed.
So I want to maybe clarify something.
Sure.
I've been part of teams that do retrospectives that don't have like action items. I've been in retros that's like, there's assigned action items or assigned projects, or like, hey, we're going to pick this up next sprint. And I've done retros where that was explicitly not a goal. It was, if we see a thing, we're going to have another conversation to set a goal. And that second group has often change came of the meeting, but there wasn't defined action. I wonder if maybe I'm thinking of what defined action means differently.
So I guess in the second example where you said that there wasn't any actions or intended actions to come out, there could be other maybe implicit actions or change impacted. So, you know, sometimes it's useful to have a retrospective to celebrate things, right? Like to create a sense of winning or team camaraderie or something like that. To that sense, I would not necessarily call that a retrospective. So I think that is useful if it helps the team bond and it helps the team sort of grow further on its team journey. But I wouldn't necessarily label it as a retrospective.
It's interesting. I think you're right that where those have gone well, they're mostly cross-functional. Let's celebrate what's winning and then elevate what's kind of broken to people who might not otherwise have that visibility. So we do right now, we do retro that is sales and customer support and engineering. And a lot of it is, yeah, it's really about the winning. So I'm going to get some free consulting here. So in that retro right now, what we've noticed a pattern of recently is that we do kind of a highlights, challenges, learnings format. And we're finding that a lot of the highlights are team, about things we did as a team, like success. And a lot of the challenges are mostly individual. And it seems like there are some team challenges that aren't really getting surfaced. And I was wondering if you had a team that was expressing that pain, what they might change up, or maybe even, is it bad?
I've seen this in a couple of places. So it feels like a pattern where I've seen where teams, you know, everything is rosy, everything is celebration, but there's something that seems to be avoided, like the elephant in the room. Nobody is talking about the hard topic. And it feels like that sort of pattern. And I think there's a couple of things there. So one is actually about safety. So you get this a lot, perhaps if you have different people from different departments, because they're not normally a team, right? So they work very differently. They have different goals and they're not really a team. It's a group of people. And so safety might be an issue where some people, when they're in front of people they've not really worked very closely with, might feel a bit awkward about sort of talking or calling out something that's not going very well. I think it can also happen when perhaps there are sort of senior people or line managers there. As a C-level, I was very careful not to drop into team environments. Or if I did, I really wanted to make sure that the safety was high, because I know that people will sort of clam up around, oh, like, are we going to be evaluated and sort of slapped over the wrist for this later? So once again, it sort of changes the tone of the retrospective to everything is fine, everything's great. And then some of those topics don't really sort of get addressed there. I think sometimes, and this is where I think perhaps some teams, this is where I actually think changing up a team can be actually quite useful as well. Some teams just kind of get into a habit where, you know, they've teamed or formed so well and worked so well together, but then they're a bit blind to some of where their weaknesses are as a team. And so maybe sometimes those issues, once again, don't get called up. And that's where maybe shaking up the team can actually be quite useful. Sometimes having a external party come in and sort of say, hey, like, you seem to be dancing around this like ugly or awkward, strange issue. Why aren't you focusing on that? Because that one feels like you could unlock a lot more, I don't know, team feel, productivity, or actually address that issue.
So you would look at safety, then you would look at, you know, is there someone like hierarchy up that might be impacting people's ability to save, be safe, and then maybe even bring in someone outside to shake things up and go back to your like change things up in general being a benefit.
Yeah, almost like bringing in like a devil's advocate or somebody to just ask difficult questions, right? Not to judge, but just to ask the hard questions.
I like it. I'm gonna change our retro format next week. So thanks for advice.
Good luck.
Thanks. Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help engineering teams hire better fit developers faster. We do that by finding hidden gems in their hiring pool. What's a hidden gem? Take one of our customers. They're hiring for a DevOps engineer and struggling to find a great fit. According to LinkedIn's recent research, DevOps is the hardest position to hire for. So this experience is pretty common. So our customer kicks off with us. They've been struggling to hire this DevOps role. And then we get started and a candidate comes in. Let's call him Matt. Matt's last title was Test Automation Engineer. Not an ideal fit for DevOps role. Usually Matt does not make it past the resume phase. Instead, with Woven, he got a chance to spend an hour showing what he can do, actually doing DevOps work, writing scripts, understanding architecture. After seeing the results from his work simulation, our customer interviewed Matt, loved him. He went on site, they loved him, and he's killing it. Here's what the manager had to say after he hired Matt. Without Woven, we would have missed out on Matt. We wouldn't have gained such a high caliber teammate. He had a test automation title as last job, and now he's crushing the DevOps role. It's day three, and he's already automated parts of our infrastructure on day three. If you want to see how we can help you find a great hire like Matt, we'll build you a tailored demo link for you to explore. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo. So there's a phrase I've seen going around Twitter, write tests, not too many, mostly integration. What maybe do you don't fully agree with about that statement?
I think for me, I grew up in the sort of land of TDD. And I think one of the great things that TDD gives you is a lot of safety. I understand the sentiment of writing not too many tests because there is a maintenance cost to tests that people forget. But I think also there's a lot of loss in speed of feedback and a lot of safety that you lose if you focus too much on integration tests. So where I've worked on teams with a really good testing suite, you know, I think unit tests are the bedrock of sort of feedback because you can make changes, get really instantaneous feedback, but they have to be well-written. And I think this is the hard thing, is that there has been a couple of books about sort of well-written tests, but I understand that a lot of people, you know, when they're starting out, they're learning how to write tests. They're learning how to do TDD. And in that process, you can often write really brittle unit tests. And I think that's where a lot of that statement comes from, which is sort of the overhead of maintaining very brittle tests. But I think I've learned over time that by really thinking about the types of tests that you want to write, you know, they shouldn't be too brittle, right? And I think that's kind of the way that this sort of sentiment is going, is that, you know, by saying it shouldn't be brittle, then we just move up a layer. I disagree with that, right? Because I think I come from the school of sort of coding where you think a lot more closely about objects' responsibility and the contract between them. And if you really define and model that much stronger, you can write much more stable tests instead of perhaps other tests where I've seen where everyone tries to mirror the implementation of a method line by line in tests. And of course, when you refactor and change the order, tests break. So for me, I think I disagree with that because it's an easy answer of saying, oh, writing good unit tests is hard, so skip them. But actually, I think the good unit tests that you write will teach you better design. And they give you much, much faster feedback as well. Of course, this is all super contextual because, you know, there's times where, of course, I would also skip tests, right? Like if you're hacking and prototyping, early stage startup trying to find market fit, I probably wouldn't invest too much time on lots of unit tests. But, you know, I've worked on really complex sort of business logic sort of areas where, you know, pricing engines where you really want very fast feedback. You can't wait for integration tests to run sometimes because you need to find ways of breaking things up into step-by-step processes. But in doing so, you improve both the design of the system and you're by like trying to understand where the decoupled sort of areas are to write good unit tests. And so it is a design aid as well. And I think by sort of relying on integration tests, you kind of lose that focus.
So can you define brittle in the context of unit tests? I think that might help. It seems like the brittleness of unit tests maybe is the crux of the argument.
Yeah, so a really good test for brittleness of unit tests is like if you change one line in a method or something that's well encapsulated, how many tests break? That can be a sign of over-testing. And that's often the reaction of going, oh, well, we should just do it at a higher level. Often it means that it's too coupled to the order or sequence. So good unit tests shouldn't be coupled to order or sequence. And you shouldn't over-test, right? So I think there's a school of thought that says, okay, well, we need a single unit test separate from each other for every behavior in a function or something like that. Sometimes it makes sense just to have one test per function testing many scenarios. Like, you know, I think it comes back down to judgment of really, is the cost value there? But I think a good test is, yeah, if you change something in a method or a function, and like tens of tests suddenly break, then you've probably created two brittle tests.
So maybe it's right tests, not too brittle, and then mostly a mix, or mostly unit, would you say?
No, I think you still need a mix. I mean, yeah, there are different levels. I don't have a catchy phrase, actually. I can't summarize that so quickly. I would probably add, remember, tests are there to give you feedback about design, and you shouldn't forget about design. Tests are always giving you feedback. It's up to you to listen to that feedback or not.
I like it. We'll make an acronym with that sentence. That's what we'll do anytime anybody quotes that on Twitter. What are some heuristics you might use to know if you have adequate tests on a particular system?
So I think one of the things that I look at is often what is called sort of failure demand. So different sort of parts of software calls this different things, right? So if you get multiple cases of the same class of error, it means you're not capturing something and you're not preventing that sort of situation from happening again. In SRE land, right, they have postmortems to try to prevent the process that led to the incident. It's kind of very similar for testing, right? So I think when you start to track issues or bugs or issues, what you're trying to do is to see if you're repeating the same type of issue, right? So you can fix it and then, you think it's fixed and then it surfaces again, or you get 10 customers reporting the same type of thing. It means you probably haven't really done either the root cause of that, or you've not put tests in place to give you early feedback about when that breaks. So I think that's probably something that I would use as a heuristic to see if there's enough sort of testing. I think the other one is also what I look for is really how early is it that people creating code get feedback about their code at different levels, right? So if the first time that people get feedback is from a customer, that can be really damaging depending on the type of business you're in or the scale that you're in, right? So I'm always looking at sort of balancing the speed with the speed of feedback and making sure that engineers get fast levels of feedback. And, you know, I'd look at normal, levels of this, like static code analysis to look for normal bugs, unit testing to see if there's a minimal set of these sorts of things. Integration testing, acceptance testing to catch different types of classes of bugs. But that's definitely a case of like, you don't want to have too much because once again, it leads to that brittleness problem, but you should have a good balance. But the hard thing about software, it's about a judgment, and defining what a good balance is part of the art of building good software.
I think those are two super helpful heuristics. Am I getting repeated types of classes of bug? That's a heuristic to dive deeper. I'm not building the right type of test, and when am I getting feedback? If it's from the customer or it's from the end-to-end tests that take 15 minutes. Maybe there's something I could do to get faster feedback on that class of bug. So as your time with your time at CTO at N26, you 4X'd, more than 4X the size of your 7X the size of your engineering team. What did you have to change about your hiring process to make that possible?
I'd like to say everything, but actually reflecting upon it, we didn't need to change everything. We actually had a pretty good sort of level of interview process. So the stages were good, but what we needed to do was change a lot of the things around it. And so this was really about, in order to scale your team, you need to think whether or not your processes are scalable as well. So we actually initiated a project with the people department called Talia. Talia is a Greek god, or Greek name at least, and it is intended to mean blossom, right? So we thought that was a good metaphor for helping our tech team blossom. And so we wanted to really look at everything in the entire chain. So for me, recruiting is only one aspect of the entire chain of a sort of employee life, right? So part of it is like candidate experience before they join. And so we really needed to work on things like employee brand and awareness. Like there was none of that in existence, at least from a tech side when I sort of first came in. We did really want to look at our recruiting process and how did we make that sort of scale as the organization scaled as well. So, you know, I know that engineers will get interview fatigue after a while, right? Is that, you know, they join a company because they want to write and produce code that has impact. They don't just want to do interviewing. And so we also needed to think about how did we sort of scale up our recruiting onboarding process internally to make sure that we trained new people, to make sure that they were consistent and they understood what their sort of part of that interviewing process was, to define what that process was so that people understood how that fit into the bigger picture of, you know, what other people were looking at and how things would get wrapped up.
I'd love to dig into that training piece. How did you train consistency in interviewers, like on a practical basis?
So practically, there's a couple of things. So one is just being very clear about the process, right? So some of the tech people would take part in two parts of it. So our process looks like a recruiter call to sort of give context about the company, about the role. I'm talking about some engineering specific roles where it's coding. And then there would be a sort of technical interview with an engineer, just a sort of early to see how that goes. There'd be a code test. And then depending on the role, then there would be sort of the pair sort of evolution of that code if they sort of get past that part. And then there would be a sort of cultural fit. And so, you know, one of the interesting things that we noticed on the recruiting, as we were looking at the scaling up of this, is like, what did people think their part of their role was? So for instance, a lot of people during the technical interviewing were trying to test for cultural fit. And, you know, we said, actually, don't worry about that because like I'll test for that at the end. Other engineering managers will test for that at the end. Your unique value add to this sort of value chain of information is to really focus on exploring the types of capabilities from a technical perspective to see if you're happy with that. We'll test for things like collaboration and things like this as well. And so defining that process, defining what area should focus on, and then also running interviewing training to get people up there. So sometimes there'd be like formal interview training, which is like generally, how do you ask questions? How do you make a candidate comfortable? You know, some engineers can get to a point where like they're testing for very specific knowledge, whereas we really want to make sure that we're testing for principles and we understand that people may lack specific knowledge, but the question is, do they understand, could they give it an example in a different sort of context? So sort of testing more, like helping people understand how to interview well. And then we also sort of, as we were sort of training new people, they would also shadow existing people as well. So they could sort of understand how other people were sort of running that. And that's kind of how we ran the interview training. But yeah, as I said, like the recruiting and that interview process was a little bit only one part of that. We also really wanted to revise our onboarding process. So we revamped that. And as a benefit, the whole company benefited from that as well, because nobody had really looked at general onboarding. But of course, then there's more technical onboarding as well on top of that. And for me, the other key thing is it doesn't really stop there, but it's also about the environment in which people work. And this is really about sort of the diversity and inclusion part, which is making sure that, you know, when you have such a big collection of people from so many cultures, so many backgrounds, does everyone bring their full self, or can they feel like they can bring their full self to work because they feel included? And so that's a real key element of something that I was also working on So for instance, I introduced a diversity channel on our Slack to start talking about why that's important and awareness. We put in some bots to start correcting some very normal, easy to understand language like guys, you know, it's actually, there's more than guys in the organization. Some of that sort of stuff that, you know, they're going to get annoyed at the bot, but nobody, no person's going to suffer. We sponsored some activities for International Women's Day, for CSD, which is effectively Pride in Berlin, to really try to make sure that everyone felt really included, to make sure that they could, you know, bring their full potential to work.
So it sounds like you were focused to make hiring work to 7X. It was employer brand, the recruiting, actually interview process, so training, standardization, making sure that people knew exactly what they're testing. And then it's the onboarding process itself. And then finally, it's diversity and inclusion to make sure folks are actually included once they start. I would love to know more about that employer brand piece, because I hear talk to a lot of startups. They're, you know, in the same market as Salesforce or Amazon or Google. And a common refrain is like, I can't compete against Amazon or Google. I don't have an employer brand. What's like the minimum viable employer brand look like?
I think you have to work out what your story is. So every company is different because it's a different company. Like, there's a different culture. There's a different level. And I think when you're there, and, you know, I mean, when we started, and even now, we're significantly smaller than Amazon or significantly smaller than Google, right? So we also suffer from the same sort of thing. But I think for me, one of the interesting things about employer branding is kind of my understanding of how good marketing works as well, which is, you know, being really authentic. And I think one thing that nobody really likes I'm an engineer here, but nobody really likes is like cheap and dirty marketing, which like sells you something and then you buy this thing and it's like, oh, it's not really what I expected. Because you'll never re-engage, right? Like, it's like you'll never refer it to friends. And I think one of the important parts about true marketing is really trying to be very clear about what it is that you have to offer. And I think that's the essence of what employer branding should really be, which is really awareness, right? Because there are so many things out there. And the question is, do people even know what you do? Like, what is it? Your team can be super proud internally around what you do. But if nobody around you knows about that, of course, they're not going to reach out and say, hey, I might want to be part of that one day. And so, you know, as a leader, once again, one of the things that I did in doing this was asking people, what is it that you enjoy about working here? Why are you proud to work here? What do you think? Why did you leave bigger company X to join us? What has kept you here this long, right? And I think that's the interesting key of trying to distill down what is it that you have. Naturally, part of it will be the product. You know, I have to say, I think we're lucky as a B2C sort of product in that a lot of employees are first customers as well. So there's already some awareness about what you build or what you produce. It's a little bit harder if you're a B2B product. But then once again, you have to sort of help them understand how they can have an impact. And I think this is really what a lot of people want to have. Like, you know, I think a lot of people working at Google or Amazon end up leaving because they want to have a greater impact, right? So they want to not just be a cog in a bigger, bigger machine, but they actually want to see what they do have immediate results. And so that can actually play in your advantage. But you really have to sort of really look quite deeply and closely to your organization, to your culture, about what makes you different. And you have to really be able to articulate that really well.
My guest today has been Patrick Kwa. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks again to Patrick for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, retrospectives are only as powerful as the questions we choose to ask. Early on, Patrick joined an already large organization that was going through rapid change. He needed to get a lot of information about the state of N26 to figure out what actually needed to change, what was working well. The tool he used here was retrospectives. He would go to a retrospective for each team, and then he would ask the following three questions. What things are we really proud of? What's not going well? And what's puzzling to us? Starting with what we're proud of ensures that we're going to recognize what the team is already doing well and not try to change things that are already working. My favorite question here is what's puzzling to us, and I've already implemented it, and I really like it. Sometimes people don't know how to express something, but they can't answer, what's kind of weird, what's off? Oftentimes, the most impactful questions are the easiest. How does this work? Why are we doing this? Even if you don't change anything, forcing people to explain their thought process can bring value. Number two, our teams don't actually need a world-class retrospective. The best retrospective is the one we actually run. Patrick says that retrospectives are kind of like pizza. Even if they're bad, they're still pretty good. Patrick wrote an entire book on retrospectives, but his most common advice about them is they don't actually need to be world-class to be a positive force for improvement. The key question to evaluate our retros is whether or not there is positive change happening based on the conversations. The great thing about retros is they give folks explicit permission to do something about their situation. It's no longer, I'll complain and maybe someone else does something about it. It's an active conversation and partnership to make our days better. A great retrospective results in autonomy, empowerment, and positive change. A common mistake Patrick sees about retros is repetition. Patrick recommends changing the retro format periodically just to keep it fresh and keep people engaged. A signal that we might want to change is if you see participation dropping off, people being less excited, you see a lot of repetition about answers. Number three, rapid change can kill morale. We must fight this problem with context. People don't want to be changed, but they don't mind change. I love that quote. Our goal is to not change people, it's to help them change themselves. We have to be conscious of the environment we're cultivating with regard to context. The things that no one feels empowered to take ownership of, the things falling between people, between teams, those are the things that it's manager's responsibility to figure out and fix. That's our job. We also must be aware that we can't force behaviors. This is the old lead a horse to water. We must introduce the context, introduce the change, and realize that people's first thought is going to be, how does this affect me? We need to create a shared understanding of how this change is going to make their life better. That's how we get behavior change. Thanks again to Patrick for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.